Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and I'm happy to say that today on this show, we have Travis Linneman, who has written a wonderful book called Meth Wars, Police, Media, Power. I don't ordinarily conduct many interviews anymore, but I got a note from the publisher, NYU Press, about this book, and I've been involved in the recovery community for many, many years, and whenever a book like this, a significant book about the war on drugs and recovery comes across my desk, I try to make time to do an interview, and I'm glad I did because Travis has written a really interesting book about meth in particular. Travis and I, as you'll find out in the course of the interview, are both from the Midwest. In fact, we're both from Kansas, which is, I think, the first time on this show that I've had somebody from Kansas. That can't be true. But anyway, two Kansans talking about meth wars. I think it's going to be an interesting interview. So, Travis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Travis Linneman, obviously. I'm a assistant professor of justice studies at Eastern Kentucky University, which is in Richmond, Kentucky. I'm a sociologist by training. I'm in my third year at Eastern Kentucky, and I was at Old Dominion University for 3 years in the course of writing this book as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had a life before academia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I feel like I've been around. I came to academia a little bit late in life. Like a lot of people, I suppose, that write about criminal justice and criminal justice issues. I started out as a practitioner. Exposure to it early on, working in youth group homes, and just kind of, jumped from job to job until I ended up as an intensive probation officer in Manhattan, Kansas. And that was around 1998, and that's kind of what introduced me to what would eventually be the framework and topic of the book. So 1998, the state and federal governments were really ramping up or broadcasting concern. Alarmist kind of warnings about methamphetamine. So I would attend trainings and receive instruction from my supervisors and from the courts about the issues allegedly surrounding meth. And I'd go in the field and look for those things. And oftentimes I didn't find the instructions that I was receiving from my supervisors and the rhetoric coming from state and federal governments was necessarily lining up with my observations. So several years later, I found myself in graduate school and I was looking for a topic for a dissertation and started reviewing, literature on drug war in general with an eye to write something on mass imprisonment, particularly how mass imprisonment might actually be observed and, how we could document the effects of mass imprisonment in small communities in the rural Midwest where I'm from. And I just kept coming back to meth, either from key kind of signposts in the literature, but also conversations that I had with key people, whether they were academics or practitioners in the field. The kind of this juncture between political rhetoric and my experiences as a practitioner and also somebody that grew up in a small town in Kansas, led me to think that there might be a useful question there for a dissertation project.
Mm-hmm. So the topic found you. You didn't find the topic.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I tried to avoid it for several years, and it just kept coming back.
Yeah, well, it's a very important topic. It's certainly something that Americans think about a lot. I think if I've read your book correctly, they probably think about it too much. But let's begin with what is really the theoretical framework for the book and one key concept, and that is the methamphetamine imaginary, which you talk about in the introduction. I don't think many people are going to be familiar with this terminology. Can you describe what an imaginary is and what the methamphetamine imaginary is?
Yeah, I'm kind of drawing from a lot of different places, and so I kind of have my own take on Zizek's Lacanian framework. But basically, the methamphetamine imaginary describes how people imagine their relationships to one another, to the community, to the world through this particular drug. And then also that branches in more broadly to the idea of a drug war imaginary. So how everyday interactions can be structured by this notion of a very harmful substance in the community, people who use this harmful substance in the community, and how that might pattern everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I look to literature, film, television, but also the words and actions of everyday people.
Mm-hmm.
To see how this imaginary effect might be at work.
Mm-hmm. And I would say one of the things that you and I both know, being from the Midwest and all, is how it is associated with the Midwest, and particularly the rural Midwest.
Oh, absolutely. That's what I found particularly useful about meth, or at least interesting about meth, is that it's, you know, perhaps the only drug that's more, you know, most strongly associated with not only the Midwest, but with working class white people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mentioned my interest in mass imprisonment. Mass imprisonment is oftentimes associated with people of color and you know, cities and cities, central cities in particular. And so in thinking about how mass imprisonment might appear in the rural Midwest, you know, this drug that, you know, we were really ramping up, you know, interest in, also strategies on how to control it in the late 90s, made kind of a useful sort of lens to think about these questions, but also a way to kind of understand class and race in a unique way
mm-hmm.
in the context of the mass imprisonment.
Well, I first encountered methamphetamine, let's just put it that way, in the 80s. And in the 80s, I was in the Midwest, and at that time, it was well below the radar. It was not a drug of choice for almost anybody, but except I had heard that bikers did it a lot, although I never met a biker who did it, to be honest with you.
Right.
I knew that it was called crank, but I only learned that later after encountering it, and a lot of it was from Germany. I don't know what was up with that, but in any event – In the 90s, as you say, it really became a focus both for law enforcement and then a little bit later for the media. Can you talk about how methamphetamine became a focus of attention for these folks?
Sure. Well, you know, I think part of the reason it was off the radar is because it was so strongly associated with, you know, a small population of folks, whether it be, you know, the outlaw motorcycle subculture, but also just associated with working class whites. And that, you know, to that point in our history of drug control, we haven't necessarily focused on working class whites as a population that's necessarily at risk or so-called or supposedly responsible for, you know, the ills of a particular drug. So, you know, when I think certain police agents, certain politicians wanted to draw attention to their jurisdictions and to their constituents, but also bring in money, methamphetamine lent itself as a nice kind of ideological tool to say, hey, look, we have problems with drugs here. You know, we have drug war terrain here as well. And, you know, to kind of move the discourse from the city to the country, what was particularly viable, I think. And then for the media, that just made a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a very useful and old tale, the demise of rurality, the demise or the threatened wholesome landscapes of the breadbasket or middle America or the heartland. So regardless how something like this might happen, whether it be the collapse of family farms or, you know, the rise of a particularly noxious drug focused on this particular part of the country, that tale is, I think, particularly enticing and useful or interesting for some folks. So I think that's why, you know, the rise in meth happened when it did, and why it, you know, it's continued to be associated with, you know, certain segments of the population, certain spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you again that when I first encountered it, it was in Arkansas, actually. And I was, of all things, working at a sawmill. And it was not a recreational drug. it was being used by guys I worked with to help them get through the day, because the work that we did, I didn't do it. I'll be honest with you. At that time, I did not do it. But there were a lot of guys who did, but you know, they worked, they had to do these jobs that were incredibly hard and monotonous. And so they would do a little of it, and it would, you know, it would be like, you know, it was an aid to them. I don't know how else to put it. It was not something you went home and did. It was something you did before you went to work.
Sure, absolutely. And I've run across and experienced, you know, just via interviews and comments from other users, you know, the meatpacking industry, particularly in Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa, that is a common assertion that folks, you know, continue to use this drug to pick up extra shifts.
And it worked. I can tell you, these guys worked a lot harder than I did. I'm not sure it was good for them, but they did it. Because at the time in the 80s, again, the focus was really on, first of all, it was on intravenous drug use because of AIDS, but it was really on cocaine, which I didn't encounter very much in the Midwest because it's too expensive.
Right. Yeah. And it was also less on cocaine and more on crack. So
yeah, crack. Exactly. Crack. Yes. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Make the comment that was because that was associated with people of color in the inner city, that, you know, the drug war kind of laid off, the rural Midwest for a while.
Can you point to any particular moment or series, couple of years in which it really burst onto the kind of public consciousness? I don't remember. That's an honest question. I really don't know.
Well, I think that the threat of, you know, what they called clandestine labs or Klan labs, you know, the quote unquote mom and pop cook, what police called Beavis and Butthead cookers, these local people involved in the drug culture that set up labs, you know, in their garage or in their basement and produce just enough methamphetamine for themselves and other people. I think that particular kind of the way that it, brought a certain sort of spatialization to communities, and because, you know, the production is harmful to the environment, harmful to the people that are in the environment, it can be explosive, these sorts of things. It had a way of localizing the threat in a way. And, you know, this wasn't necessarily just drugs being trafficked in from Mexico, so to speak. You know, these were drugs being produced by potentially somebody next door.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that made it, that was particularly kind of alarming for everyday people. But then again, I think it was compounded by the fact that the feds didn't really track methamphetamine at all until the late 90s, and didn't track meth labs in any sort of systematic way until then. So when they started to do it, you know, they had a kind of natural explosion, so to speak, in the number of labs that they were able to report on. So all of a sudden they had this, you know, in a way, socially constructed phenomenon. They started recording on it at a certain time, and they said, oh, you know, from year X to year Y, we've had, you know, this percent increase. So used in a kind of a disingenuous sort of way, you know, you have a ready-made epidemic. Now, I don't know if those stats, I would be pretty surprised to find that those stats necessarily reflected an actual change in production, and more were just not a reflection of improved recording practices that made it look like there was this explosion.
Yeah, I see just what you mean.
I think those things.
I was going to say, even in the early 80s when I first encountered it, and some of it was from Germany, I was told by people, I won't say who, that you could make it from Sudafed. And I thought that was kind of amazing. Oh, yeah. And then I lost track of it for a long time. Must have been 15 years. And then I went to buy Sudafed at the drugstore, and they told me they needed my ID. And I did not understand that at all. And then I thought back. I thought, what's going on there?
Yeah, that's kind of a consequence of legislation that kind of occurred at the tail end of what I would consider the, you know, the federal government's real interest in methamphetamine in 2005. there was state legislation, kind of model legislation that sprung up in states like Oklahoma and Kansas that sought to restrict pseudoephedrine, which is kind of one of the main precursors for that type of local small methamphetamine production. And then it was passed as part of the Patriot Act in 2005, the re-up of the Patriot Act. So there's a small rider or a provision called the Combat Methamphetamine Act that was included in the Patriot Act that made pseudoephedrine restrictions federal law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a component of, you know, what I would call the methamphetamine imaginary almost. So when, you know, when you encounter this restriction, you know, you're led, or you're almost, you know, forced to wonder, you know, why do we have these restrictions? What type of people are in the community that cause such a law, and how might they still be, in play in the everyday?
And this was at the same time, I have to say, this was in, I guess, 2005, between 2005, 2010. And I came to understand that all of my students were on Adderall.
Oh, yeah. So
I was sort of wondering about the hypocrisy of this, but, you know.
Well, yeah, Adderall is widely prescribed, and, you know, methamphetamine has been sold legally under the brand name Desoxin for 70 years in the United States.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it is very much kind of contradictory.
Oftentimes,
police aren't sure about that.
So in your research, you talk a lot about the way in which the press and the media have taken this to town, so to say. And one of the things you discuss is, of course, Breaking Bad, which was kind of a revelation to me. I watched it, and I thought it was entertaining. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. I use Breaking Bad to kind of more explain or flesh out this idea of the imaginary. So Breaking Bad, you know, tells the story, this really interesting, captivating story of Walter White, just an average, everyday chemistry teacher, well, brilliant chemistry teacher, who, gets ill and is forced to enter the drug trade as a way to provide for his family should he die. The narrative of the story basically, it hinges upon or focuses on methamphetamine. So, you know, I think the most gravitating part of the series is its characters, particularly Walter White. You know, you begin, you know, really caring about the guy, and you're constantly flipping back and forth in, having empathy for him, but then also hating his actions. And he really does kind of become a monster. So his transformation from a, you know, milquetoast chemistry teacher to a drug kingpin, this, you know, monstrous murderer, hinges upon methamphetamine. And so I think that's a very useful sort of window into this idea, you know, when a crime occurs, do we go searching for, you know, the old standby stereotypical explanations? Was the person on drugs? Were they stealing to provide for their habit? And with Walter White, we ask those same sort of things. You know, did he do it to provide for his family, or did he do it because he was a power-hungry megalomaniac? And I think the question we should have been asking all along that Breaking Bad never really gets at is, why was a decent school teacher without decent health care,
sure,
without life insurance for his family and these sorts of things?
Mm-hmm.
But our fixation on the lure of the drug trade and the darkness of the violence that obviously is always connected to the drug trade always, I think, tends to overshadow that. So if it does it in the imaginary with Walter White, I think we can also look for the ways that we use methamphetamine and the drug war also to overshadow kind of some of these more grim realities of everyday life,
mm-hmm,
for people, you know, in the quote unquote real world. So,
yeah. Well, this sort of,
go ahead.
I was going to say, it sort of takes me back to the guys that I knew in the sawmill and other people I met later. One of the things that Breaking Bad doesn't do is talk about the end users of Walter White's products. And you gain no information about them other than there are a couple of characters in the show who are described as tweakers, I think, and they are completely helpless,
mm-hmm.
Completely 100% helpless. That's not my experience.
Absolutely.
With people that use this stuff.
No, yeah, and, you know, again, the question's not asked, well, why are they using it, or, you know, what else is going on in their life? They're just kind of degraded junkies without any sort of human agency or complexity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a thing that we tend to do with people that we deem drug users or addicts.
Yeah, it was a kind of startling omission from Breaking Bad, because a standard sort of sub-narrative in these sorts of television productions or movies is they usually follow an end user. I'm thinking of something called Traffic, which was originally a German production.
And, oh, yeah.
And then in that, you do actually follow somebody who is a user of heroin. It's a politician's daughter, if I recall correctly. And, you know, she crashes and burns pretty dramatically. But that's completely absent from this. You don't ever meet an end user, as far as I know, in Breaking Bad.
Not so much. I think the two, you know, very stereotypical, you know, quote unquote meth heads, their characters, their names are even Spooge and Skank.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the guys I'm thinking about. Yeah, right. Those are exactly the guys I'm talking about. And they are not typical. Not in my experience.
And abuse their child and, you know.
Yeah.
All the stereotypical things that we associate with drug users.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, that's a strong omission from, there's a lot of omissions, I think, from Breaking Bad.
Well, you know, it is.
I do like the show.
It's TV. We can't. So right. One of the things I'm particularly interested in is the epidemiology of meth. And you talk a little bit about it. Do we have any idea about how many Americans use it? Or whether there have been an increase or a decrease or anything like that? Are there any reliable indicators of it? And I ask that with a certain degree of skepticism, because this is the kind of thing people lie about. So I don't know how you would get good stats on this.
Right. You know, the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, which has its problems and has been critiqued pretty widely, is the source of data that government agencies tend to point to. So it's, you know, the best sort of data that I think that government agencies have, particularly long term. And that survey has shown over probably the last 5 or 6 years, less than 1/10 of 1% of the population uses meth, according to that survey.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be, you know, say it's wrong, say it's really wrong. Double that, double it again,
sure.
And we're still not anywhere near the number of people that the same survey says abuses prescription drugs, for instance,
or alcohol, or any number of different drugs. Yeah.
Yeah. So for they report around, it's been pretty stable. 450,000 people, according to that survey, in the most recent year, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So not a lot, particularly for the amount of time that this is occupied in our popular culture. I think again, the actual representation of this drug in the community probably doesn't meet what our popular culture suggests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly interested in how it became associated with the Midwest. And let me ask another epidemiological question. Is there any evidence that people use it more in the Midwest than any place else?
Anecdotal evidence. There's some pretty interesting and good work by Ralph Wieschite at Illinois State University. And he's actually done some GIS mapping of meth labs and then also seizure data. And, his kind of conclusion was that meth markets tend to spring up in geographical locations that are absent of a cocaine supply.
Mm-hmm.
So in out of the way rural places that don't have, connection to cocaine markets, methamphetamine might, particularly, the early production in clandestine labs, by local producers, kind of filled a stimulant void, so to speak. If you couldn't get cocaine, you methamphetamine was an option. And so I guess it follows, they've called meth poor man's cocaine for years. White man's crack also, I've heard from users. So that seems plausible. The first Philip Jenkins, a historian at the University of Pennsylvania, wrote a paper in
or a paper and a book, and I believe 1991. And the first meth markets that the federal agencies had identified and that he discusses, Pennsylvania, particularly Philadelphia, and that was associated again with a outlaw motorcycle group, but then the West Coast and Hawaii. And so at that time, particularly the rural Midwest was not considered, borrowing from Nick Redding's book, Methland.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was a considerable amount of cultural and political work that helped kind of push the narrative and fix it in states like Iowa and in Kansas and Missouri in particular. But then also, some significant changes, like I said, with the lab production rates and things like that helped kind of bolster that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any idea how much of it is produced in mom and pop labs and how much of it is produced in kind of factories in Mexico or someplace else?
Well, yeah, I mean, the 2005 Combat Methamphetamine Act, the federal government will tell you that that act and also the state legislation before that significantly interrupted the clandestine production in the United States. I'm a little skeptical of that, and I think I try to show this in the book that the lab seizure rates, at least in states like Kansas, were dropping prior to the imposition of those laws. But it is usefully lined up, I think, at least politically, with a renewed focus on Mexican drug cartels. So now, there's actual policy papers and even speeches and these sorts of things that in very certain terms say we've solved the clandestine methamphetamine problem, but that hasn't reduced demand. Now meth is coming from Mexico via cartels. The DEA we're looking at Mexican cartels for meth trafficking in the early 90s, and I don't think that that ever really changed much on the on the importation end. So I think it's more of a political device to accomplish other things and kind of bolster the threat of Mexican drug trafficking.
Yeah, I would say, and I don't know for a fact, but I don't think that meth is terribly attractive to drug cartels and such because there's not a lot of money in it. It's powerful and pretty cheap to make.
Think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just my guess. Now let's go. I saw a little bit like your book crossed my desk. I saw a number of years ago, whenever it came out, Nick Redding's book, Methland, and we interviewed him. I interviewed him about the book, and the book was featured on the front cover of the New York Times Sunday Book Review, which is every publisher and author's dream. And I talked to Dick, and he's a sensible guy. And he went to a place I knew. I was actually teaching at the University of Iowa at the time. And I knew where Old Wine was. I'd been there. Can you talk a little bit about that book and its reception and production and so on and so forth?
Sure. I think his book, it's an interesting book, but I think what it does is it taps into this idea of a threatened way of life and a threatened land. I found it very interesting. He settled on Iowa and Old Vine in particular because he, found some people that would talk to him. And so, he could have settled on Marysville, Kansas, which is where I grew up, and maybe have written the same sort of book. I get that sense. So I think that there was definitely at least a market for the combination of this idea of declining rurality, declining place, threatened America, threatened American sort of life, and particularly attractive when combined with crime and drugs and this so-called depravity of the drug scene. So I think that those things combined made the book particularly attractive, and it offered something that a lot of the, the literature, both academic and more popular press stuff, hadn't up to that point, was the idea of the drug war landing in middle America in a very kind of captivating sort of way. I think the most telling sort of thing is the reception that the book got from residents of Old Vine. I actually made a special trip and spent a couple of days in that area to take a look at it and to get a sense if it really was, you know, meth land. And, you know, it seemed very familiar to me. It was very much like the town I grew up in. It was, you know, nice Midwestern farm town.
Mm-hmm.
And so the folks there, I think, were a little put off or taken aback by the representation of their community. But interestingly, I think that part of their objection wasn't necessarily, you know, the problem with meth. I think that in many ways they embrace this idea that they have, you know, big city social problems as well. But their objection was more on like recovery and how the community had rebounded from the problems that they saw being associated with meth. But, you know, the things that they pointed out were all things related to the economy. Mm-hmm. They weren't related to methamphetamine. They related to economic development. And so I think they saw the community going through problems like a lot of small towns in the rural Midwest are experiencing, have been experiencing, and they kind of transpose meth onto those problems in a way to kind of, I think, maybe avoid them or make them a little easier to understand, and then saw the maybe the disappearance of the meth problem or the ability to address the meth problem, not so much associated with the kind of political economic situation that the community was facing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, I spent a lot of time looking at, you know, responses from the community on message boards and in reviews of meth land. And, you know, that's one of the things that they focused on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess having read the book, I think Nick did a service in bringing this to the attention of a lot of people, primarily on the East Coast and the West Coast. I, again, being from the Midwest, I don't particularly find myself supporting this narrative that there's been some long secular decline. Things have changed a lot. People in the Midwest move a lot. They change jobs a lot. It's an evolving place. It always has been. You know, one of the things that always surprises me is how little people from the East and West Coast know about light industry in places like Old Vine and how important it is. You know, you mentioned the meat packing industry. It's absolutely fundamental to many places like that. In Old Vine, it was the railroad. The railroad was huge there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you go there, there were some really neat sort of artifacts of the heyday of the railroad industry. And they think of it as, you know, a place where there are farmers. But in fact, it's a place that's pretty industrial and has always been, you know, since the late 19th century. And a lot of that industry moves around a lot. I mean, I'm from a place where there are, you know, aircraft factories, and sometimes they are going great guns and sometimes they aren't. And you know, the fortunes of Wichita, Kansas, where I'm from, really depend on that to a great degree. And so the fact that they have big city problems is no surprise to me. I mean, Wichita is a pretty big city. Yes. You're from Maryville. You would know that. I mean, it's a big city.
Sure.
And you know, there were race riots in my high school, not to mention the drug trade. That was well known. So I found it a little bit. I mean, I guess it was his service was, you know, sort of pointing out that this place is like a lot of other places, and it's undergoing really significant changes. And some of them come with some attendant social problems like methamphetamine use. Again, in that book as well, and I don't know, I haven't read it recently, but I don't think there's a single meth user who's a functional person in it. They're all tweakers.
And that is not
my experience with meth users, is that many of them are very functional individuals.
Yeah, sure. That's a very common narrative anytime we talk about drug users in general. You know, we hardly consider folks that can manage a life. I mentioned in the book, there's very similar things like in meth land, you know, particularly about people that have disfigured themselves, stealing anhydrous ammonia in the lab process. But a woman who brought her child to the emergency room and you know, was later found that she had exposed the child to her meth consumption. So she was smoking meth with the child in her house. And the narrative of the news broadcast that I took this from, really implied that, you know, a person who uses meth is not capable of loving their children.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I don't think is necessary.
No, that's not true. And, that's just false.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, these people can also have jobs and do have jobs and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned again, to go back to the meatpacking industry, I know a little bit about it. I don't think people understand what it means to work in a meatpacking plant. I don't think they get it. It's brutally hard work.
Yeah, I lasted 7 days
when yeah,
I was in my early 20s in Emporia, Kansas, at Iowa Beef Packing Plant.
Right.
It's not fun at all.
No, it's not. And you would probably want to have stimulants, too, if you worked in one of those places. I know the sawmill kicked my ass, and I know people who have worked in the beef packing industry, and it's just absolutely brutal. I don't want to say that these things are good for people, but it's understandable why they use them in this way. But this is right. A part of the narrative which is never mentioned. You know, we'll give school children tons of Adderall so they can do better on their SAT. But when, you know, some guy that works in a, you know, meatpacking plant does meth so he can get through the day or two shifts or something, then that's, you know, of course, horrible. We can't have that. And he can't take care of his children and so on and so forth. Which, you know, is the ripest bullshit, if you'll pardon my French. So the approach that you talk a lot about this, the approach that law enforcement took to this was, I want to use the word meretricious, meaning that they kind of used it as a way to get additional funding and to draw additional attention to themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. I think that this follows a pretty consistent pattern with law enforcement and policing in the United States, and not just related to meth, but, you know, a number of different social problems. I mean, the FBI was bolstered in the late 70s when they were facing potential budget cuts. They were bolstered by the threat of serial murder, and they really played into that threat to make sure that they were viewed as necessary by the public. There's a really interesting book by Philip Jenkins, again, who wrote a little bit about that. So with meth, the threat to the community, whether it be from labs or to children, brought in funding, does still bring in funding to states. So part of the 2008 stimulus package after the 2008 crash, one of the things that was offered to states like Kansas was a rural law enforcement methamphetamine initiative, which, you know, was a fund of several million dollars distributed directly to policing in states that had already established a problem with meth. So this could be – this money was or can be used for things like army-style weapons, body armor, these sorts of things, but also for anti-drug messaging and anti-drug education programs that haven't been shown to be necessarily useful or even in some cases harmful. So I'm talking about, you know, like DARE style programs that mm-hmm. don't enjoy a lot of empirical support. There is a project, the Meth Project, which is the brainchild of a billionaire named Thomas Siebel that lives in Montana, but basically uses these really alarmist, grotesque, shocking ads as a way to deter particularly youth meth use that also hasn't enjoyed a lot of empirical support. So, you know, this sort of, you know, the idea that this was and is a big issue for certain populations in certain locations allowed policing to kind of get some things that they needed or get some things that they wanted and bring money into the state from federal sources, but also at the state level, local communities saw an increase in resources
mm-hmm.
Directly related to this problem.
So one thing that I find interesting is that I work with recovering addicts sometimes, and particularly heroin addicts. And one of the things that has been popular among clinicians, and I think also increasingly among law enforcement agencies, is a harm reduction strategy. In other words, don't throw these people in jail. Give them some sort of maintenance so that they won't have to engage in criminality to do whatever they're doing. This has been completely absent, as far as I can tell, from the war on methamphetamine. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would definitely agree. And I think that part of that, or maybe a reason for that, is, you know, kind of the imagination of the meth user as being a super violent, erratic, quote unquote, tweaker that does absolutely horrible things because of this drug or for this drug. So there's no harm reduction for meth users, just very stiff penalties.
And this was one thing that I think I talked to Nick about when I was interviewing him about the book, is that he has an anecdote in there where he walks into a bar and he more or less says that you can always identify somebody who's using methamphetamine. That is not my experience at all.
No, I think that's pretty unfair, actually. And I try to make that point in the book and in other things I've written, and particularly this idea that was proffered by the Faces of Meth program that came out of Multnomah, Oregon, in the early 2000s. You know, the idea that meth absolutely ravishes the body of every user, but some of the indicators that are associated with meth, you know, thin frame, well, sure. Bad complexion, well, sure. Bad teeth, well, sure. But those things are also, you know, markers of other things, like not having good nutrition, working long hours, not having health care. You know, so I think it's very disingenuous to label or to create this idea of a face of meth that also might overlap with face of poverty, or, you know, face of living in a highly, you know, marginalized situation.
Yeah.
And then also we know about people that, you know, use drugs a lot. You know, people rarely just stick to one thing. So it's very difficult to say that, you know, a face is just the face of meth. It could also be a face of a number of different substances.
Yeah.
You know, here in rural Kentucky, you'll hear people talk about Mountain Dew mouth.
That's funny.
Mountain Dew mouth. It's an actual thing that, you know, people insist is a thing, that, you know, the certain people, largely poor folks in you know, the reaches of some of the haulers here, supposedly live only on Mountain Dew, and it rusts their teeth out.
One of the first things the guys in Arkansas in the sawmill told me was that Mountain Dew has the highest amount of caffeine in it of any soft drink, and that's what I should drink.
I think I've heard that as well.
I don't know if it's true, but that's what they said.
Yeah, I've heard that. Before energy drinks came into fashion, I guess.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Good point. Energy drinks. Now, they definitely are. Yeah, no, those things are crazy. One of the things I do remember, and I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about this, was, I don't know why I remember this, but meth mouth. Do you remember that?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and this was the idea. Go ahead.
That's one of the things that the Faces of Meth program really played upon, and the federal government Partnership for Drug Free America really used as this really shocking sort of signifier of meth use was, you know, the tooth decay associated with it. But there's some disagreement on this. But it's such a strong cultural image that, you know, you have a hard time arguing against it with people. But there's research by dentists that suggests that methamphetamine use isn't any more problematic for oral health than, say, something like cocaine or smoking or a number of other things you can do. So I think it was, again, a useful marker, and I think the problematic thing is it's a misapplied marker. So just like Redding said that, you know, he can spot a meth user in a bar. You know, I had a police officer tell my aunt that. You know, I mentioned this a little bit in the book, but
yeah, you do.
He came to the family farm and asked to hunt, kind of unsolicited, just showed up on the property and asked to hunt for birds on the property. And he remarked that as he drove through their little town, he was stunned by all the meth heads that he saw. And, you know, this is a really small town. I'm talking 400 or 500 people. And I can't imagine there being even that many people on the street to diagnose, other than maybe the folks that were working at the trailer factory getting out for their lunch break. And, you know, people that do hard work and, you know, just put in a hardship welding might look a little rough,
yeah,
but that isn't necessarily an indicator of drug use. So I think that's kind of problematic logic, but it's very popular and it doesn't go away.
No, it really doesn't. It's quite true. And I, as I say, I work with a lot more alcoholics than I do with drug addicts. And I can tell you, most alcoholics do not brush their teeth. I'm telling you what, that's one of the first things to go. It's one of the first things we tell them to do too. You ought to brush your teeth. but yeah, you got better things to do. So you've thought a lot about these things and we appreciate that quite a bit. I think you've tempered some of what has been said in the media. I'll call it sensationalism. I don't think you call it that, but I will, concerning methamphetamines. What should we do about it?
I would just look at our history, and particularly as it relates to drug control. We have a really well-documented history. It usually takes us, you know, we're now, you know, even people that were involved in it, as we saw with the last presidential election, with, you know, Hillary Clinton's remarks during her husband's presidency about super predators.
Yeah.
That was largely related to the drug trade and the concern about cocaine. So, you know, it might take us a few decades to start to admit that we were wrong, but we tend to get there. So we have a well-documented history of the things that we've done wrong. And I think that it would be very useful if we would look at that history while we're in the midst of a particular bout of concern and see what we've done wrong in the past and then try not to do that again. But I, up to this point, particularly in this country, particularly since the 70s and into the 80s, we've done the same thing over and over again. We might have tried a few harm reduction projects here and there, but there hasn't been a sustained interest in doing anything with illicit drugs and drug users other than treating them with police and prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right now, there's a lot of debate about the explosion or this so-called explosion of opioid abuse. And particularly in the Northeast where you're at,
yeah,
you know, there's a variety of different reasons for that. And there's some critique that, you know, the arguments for harm reduction as it relates to opioids, particularly in the Northeast, is because opioids are particularly associated with middle-class white folks. And there may actually be some validity to that argument, but, you know, in Appalachia, there has been an issue with opioids for a long time, and that hasn't been dealt with in a kind of a harm reduction sort of manner. These folks have been going to prison in Appalachia for opioid use and possession for a long time. So I think that having some long view of what has been done, might help us, you know, map a way forward, with policy and even just basic cultural practices or our understanding of these issues. I'm very skeptical of the term epidemic, even if it's actually appropriate to use, I don't find it all that helpful because it just sounds the alarm bells. And I think it leads to panic and in some cases paralysis,
mm-hmm,
for folks and definitely overreaction. You know, the history of drug control in the United States is definitely the history of overreaction for sure.
Yeah.
So looking at our history, being mindful, being critical consumers of news stories, being skeptical of the word epidemic, and then also, you know, being skeptical or at least questioning the idea that, as you pointed out, drug user is automatically a violent criminal or irredeemable. We have, you know, that's, you know, it's such a concrete entwinement, you know, in our popular culture and in our imaginary that, you know, you use drugs, particularly if you use a particular kind of drug, what, you know, other than maybe marijuana, you're automatically a violent criminal. And that's just not, that's not the case.
We no, it's have, not, not at all.
Don't have statistics that suggest that. My experience doesn't necessarily suggest that, but the word on the street does suggest that. And we need to, I think we need to contest the word on the street, because, you know, we end up treating all drug users like, you know, violent criminals. And, you know, we know what we do with those folks in this country. We put them in prison or worse.
Yeah. You know? So you know this, and I don't know the answer to this question. What happens if you get caught with a few grams of methamphetamine in Kentucky or someplace?
I haven't looked actually for the guidelines in the state of Kentucky. But in Kansas, you're looking at jail time. You know, a sugar packet of meth, regardless of, or a sugar packet size of meth, regardless of your criminal history, is going to get you 12 months in prison.
Wow.
No ifs, ands, or buts. Do not collect, you know, do not pass code, do not collect $200. And if you're associated with production, then you're looking at, you know, years, maybe upwards of a decade in prison. And interestingly, when we talk about production, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. So with the pseudoephedrine restrictions, some people have figured out how to produce enough methamphetamine just for themselves in what amounts to a small 2-liter pop bottle. So they call this the shake and bake method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Redding talks about that. The pill and some chemicals in the pop bottle and get enough for your own consumption. But in the law's eyes, that's still production. They treat the two liter pop bottle like they would treat a super lab in some instances, and a 2-liter pop bottle can get you, in Kansas at least, can get you over 10 years in prison.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and, you know, again, the striking thing is that I know from experiences with people I know, even in academia, that they go to their physician and they say, I'm having trouble concentrating, and they immediately get a prescription for Adderall just like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I guess my recommendation, if you're thinking about doing methamphetamine, is go to your doctor. Go to your doctor and tell your doctor you're having trouble concentrating. Because it's crazy to put somebody in jail for that stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, and we should actually question, you know, why am I having a hard time
concentrating?
Maybe we're rejecting the idea of long hours and tedium.
Yeah.
Maybe that's our body's natural defense against some of the stuff that we're asked to do.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a tough thing, and you're right. We're dealing with a kind of hysteria about opioid use here in the Northeast. And the people that I know who are now clean and have been, you know, in that culture for a long time, have an interesting hypothesis about it. And they say that the people that are ODing on it, and of course we have great sympathy for them, are people that don't know what they're doing. They just don't have enough experience with these drugs. And because, you know, again, just a friend of mine, a guy I know very well who was a heroin addict for many years. He said, you know, if you know what you're doing, you'll never OD. But obviously these people don't. And that's the dangerous part of it, is that they don't have the right information about how to do it. I mean, I'm not suggesting they do, but.
Or what's in the drug. In Ohio and in Kentucky, there's been a number of overdose deaths attributed to fentanyl.
Fentanyl is commonly, that's what they say. Again, my friend is very skeptical of this, but he says, yeah, fentanyl is something.
Yeah, okay.
Cut it with fentanyl. Yeah, that's right. Well. It's a kind of sad thing. My heart bleeds for the Midwest, both in the sense that I'm from there and that maybe they are suffering this thing. And I hope for harm reduction strategies. I guess I'm part of a harm reduction strategy myself, so I'm biased.
I prefer that over, you know, our current course for sure.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Well, Travis, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and I really appreciate it. So could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, you know, after this book, I started, coincidentally being interested in police violence. So I'm working on a book on police violence. It looks at that topic in a similar sort of way as the Meth Wars did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I hope you come back on the show when you're done with that project and the book comes out. Definitely get in touch with me, okay?
Glad to.
All right. Well, let me tell everybody who listens to this podcast, we've been talking to Travis Linneman about his book, Meth Wars, Police, Media, Power, and it's out from New York University Press, 2016. So thank you, Travis, for being on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you very much for listening. And we hope to talk to you soon.